cash rules everything around me. Queen, get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo.
What is going on, everybody, and welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, recording on Tuesday, June the 20th. I'm your host, Vlad Sedler. Follow me on RotoGut, at RotoGut on Twitter. I'm joined today, as you know, I have a wonderful guest every week, and this one is ever more wonderful. He's one of my favorite people in the industry, hands down. I grew up in the fantasy space, like, you know, in 10, 15 years ago, when I was first trying to make a name for myself and playing in FBC, and I grew up really admiring his work, his writing style, and specifically because I'm just a huge fan of kind of like the absurd humor, like people with really creative imaginations. It's what I really, really love. And so no surprise that he's a screenwriter by trade, and he's one of the most outspoken people in the industry and also a well-respected industry veteran as well. He is the co-founder of Razzball, and you know him well, I'm sure. Ladies and gentlemen, Gray Albright. What's up, Gray?
You made me sound so old, man. you grew up admiring me? You're like 6 months younger than me, man. Like, maybe. I don't know your age. I don't even know my age. And I don't want to talk ages right now. But, I mean, come on. You grew up.
I grew up in the fantasy industry. It's the quotation. It's the air quotes. Grew up in, you know,
tell everyone right now that I am the permanent fill-in host, co-host along with you. Like, no more. It's sorry. Official. Sorry, Maddie.
No. Maddie has his own show, actually.
Does
on
he?
Mondays.
Oh, Maddie's not on your show anymore?
No. He is. We just, because of our scheduling conflicts, he's now in the Central. He's moved closer to Chicago. I'm on the West Coast.
Oh, so since we're on the same time zone, I see. So your qualifications for a co-host are time zone. Anyone in the Pacific time zone is good by me.
If you know,
I'm glad. And if you're in the Pacific time zone,
if you can pronounce Tanner Bibee correctly, you're
Tanner Bibee.
You're in.
Man, is that how you say his name? That's shocking,
oh, dude. Yeah. Yeah, man. I learned. I'm trying to get better.
It's good to be here, Vlad. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And for those that don't, make sure you follow him at Razzball. It's just at Razzball. It's really that simple. So Gray, thank you for coming on. And dude, I mean it. You know, like in the beginning of this, I'm telling you, like in the, what is it, the aughts or whatever it is, like 2008, 2000, I really remember very well. I remember like being, you know, single guy playing in, you know, these leagues, and your articles were one of the ones I would click to because it was like, it just like literally made me laugh out loud. And this is really, really funny to me, reading your style of writing. And so I know it doesn't come from just anywhere. I know you have a history, a background that I don't know if many people know about. You know, maybe they've seen some of your tweets lately where, you know, you're out there on the picket lines with the WGA. But if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about your history in as a writer in Hollywood, I guess.
Okay. Let's see. How do I make this interesting? So I started in, I guess I started, I would say in Boston. I went to college in Boston. That's where I met Rudy, actually, at BU. Go Terriers. So we met in Boston, and then when I was in Boston, my senior year, I started doing stand-up comedy. And I stayed in Boston for like an extra 6 months, and I started working in the entertainment industry. I started working as like, you know, go-getter, a coffee, you know, a basic assistant or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was working in Boston, and then I was like, I've always wanted to go. I've always loved like the idea of LA and California and the, you know, the allure, the dream of California, I think, was always sort of interesting to me. I was never really like, you know, I grew up in Jersey, and family moved to Long Island when I was in college, but I go home to Long Island now, but I grew up in Jersey. Anyway, So I said to, I said to my family, I was like, I'm going out to LA because I was doing stand up and I wanted to get involved in the entertainment industry. And it was either go to New York or go to LA. And New York just seemed, first of all, New York's a struggle when you're already, when you're like right out of college, like it's such like, it's so hard. I don't know if I knew this consciously, but I didn't want the New York, you know, walk, the four story walk up and the like brutal heat of the summer and the brutal cold of the winter. I just didn't want it. You know, I was like, I don't know. And honestly, I don't know if that was a conscious decision or if it was just something like, because I grew up on the East Coast, I was like, let me try LA. You know, I'm not sure how conscious of a decision it was, but I knew I wanted to go into the entertainment industry. So I moved
by,
out
by
to
the
LA.
Way, and I apologize to interrupt. So would you say you were following your gut to Los Angeles?
Yeah. You know, because like I was, you know, I was dating a girl at the time and we were, you know, we had met in college and we were like, you know, we wanted to go somewhere. We didn't want to stay in Boston. And it didn't really matter where she was going to go. Like she was like, she had a job where she could go anywhere. She was working for a fashion magazine at the time. And and she was like, sure, let's try LA. And I was like, yeah, LA, let's do it. So we moved out. We actually moved out. And crazily enough, we moved out to LA the same weekend that Princess Di died. I think that was 98. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the same weekend that she died, that Labor Day weekend. And I say crazy enough because actually my wife, my current wife, I only have one. She actually moved out to Los Angeles the same exact weekend as me. And we didn't know each other. So that's just like a little random coincidence. Anyway,
from the East Coast as well.
She went to Northwestern. She moved from Chicago. Actually, was she in Chicago? Yeah, she was in Chicago. Yeah. So she moved out from Chicago, but still the same weekend. And we lived kind of near each other in LA, even though, again, we didn't know each other. We didn't know each other for about 10 years, I think. And then we met because I then started dating one of her friends, and that's how we met. But anyway, that's...
Dude, we're going to do another whole episode.
Yeah,
that's do a whole another episode on your dating life.
That's a different story. I'm only revealing all this because I know she'll never listen to this podcast. she can't even listen to the Razzball podcast. So don't take offense.
If it was Maddie Wood, Mondays with Maddie Wood, she probably listens to that, but not this one.
She does. She is a big fan of Maddie Wood's productions. she loves Maddie Wood. Anyway, so yeah, we moved out to LA. I remember probably everyone can relate to this, at least I think so. So when we moved out to LA, I remember like me and the girl at the time, we're like 21, basically just, you know, 6 months out of college or whatever. And we get to LA and I think this is probably, it's probably like this for everyone who first moves to LA. We were like, let's go. Cause LA, it's a city. Let's go and move downtown.
Nice.
It's just like, if anyone who doesn't know LA, you don't go down. You don't go and live downtown. I mean, now it's a little bit more so, but in the late 90s, it was like tumbleweeds and poverty. Like, you don't want to, like, you're just like, you're looking around. You're like, I don't want to live here. I just don't. So then we were like, okay, we'll figure out a different situation. Then we got one of those like apartment finder magazines, and we're going through that we're going through like the classifieds for like apartments, because at the time it's like you don't really have the internet. So it's really like, and we have the Thomas guide.
I was going to say you had your Thomas guide.
Yeah. The Thomas guide, for people who don't know, that was a map of LA broken up into like 300 pages.
Yeah.
So you would get like, you'd get like someone would say, oh, we're having a party. It's like, okay, what's your coordinates? You write down like the page, that the house party would be on and the coordinates of where to find it. You're like, okay, I gotta, you, everyone in LA was like a it was like Magellan basically to get to a party. You're just basically, you're navigating the entire city every time you go out, and there's no rhyme or reason with like the grids. Like in New York, you can figure out your way pretty easily, even if you don't know the city. LA, it's like, I still don't know where I'm going in LA without Waze. So anyway, we go to downtown and we see we don't want to live there. So then we're like, let's see, we can live over, how about we live in this area, Larchmont? I'm like, okay, yeah, that's fine with me. I don't know the difference. So we go and you know, long story short, I live like three blocks from where my first apartment is. I've moved around LA, but I still live. I live now, like I moved away and like I moved into my wife's place for a little while, and she used to live on the edge of Beverly Hills. And now I live now like three blocks from where my original apartment was in LA, which is, you know, it's kind of crazy. Anyway, I don't even know how I got into that story, but that's where we are.
Well, so you made it to LA.
Yes.
And you were a comedy writer. Did you do like odd and end jobs? Like you were a runner. Like,
oh my God. I had so many terrible jobs, man. I mean, I'm sure everyone was like this. When you get out of college, you're like, okay, where do I go with my poli sci degree? Poli sci? Yeah. What? What is it? What even is that? You just like, you show up at like at the unemployment line. As soon as you get out of college, you're like, okay, I guess I'm unemployed now. what's next? The only person I know who wasn't like that, like Rudy, honestly, Rudy got out of college and I feel like he got a job immediately. Like he knew exactly, like he got a job in New York doing like in the advertising industry. And it was like, he had a job, I think, for the rest of his life. Incredible, yeah. Like an incredible, like 9 to 5 was like always. Anyway, yeah, so I was doing stand up, and then I was like, I didn't really want to do stand up anymore. I wanted to do because in LA, everyone's a I don't know if we can curse on this podcast, but everyone's
you can stand-up. On occasion, yes.
Everyone's okay. Everyone's a fucking stand up. Everyone's got like, you know, everyone wants to be an actor or something. I'm like, I don't really want to do that. I didn't really like the. And then when I saw like some of my friends at the time who had been stand-ups for a while, like I looked at like their trajectory of their careers, and I'm like, the best is, you know, actually here's an example, like, you know, R.I.P. Bob Saget, but like he died in a hotel room on the road doing stand-up. It sounds awful to me. I mean, for some people they're built to do that, but like the ultimate goal for me is not being in a hotel room for like 300 nights a week, 300 nights a year. So anyway, I didn't want to do it. I honestly, stand up was like, it was okay, but I just didn't like the end goal. So then I just was like, I can write for stand ups. Like I can write jokes for other people. Why don't I just do that? So then I started doing that. And then I went to grad school and I got my my MFA, my master's in film, and when I was in grad school, my mom, you know, I was fortunate enough to not have to take loans. but my mom did say to me, she was like, when you get out of grad school, you're gonna have to, it's sink or swim time, was basically how it was put to me. And I was like, yeah, okay, I get that. And I was fortunate enough I sold my first script my last semester of grad school. So I was fortunate enough to, like, I was able to go from that directly into what I wanted to do, which was screenwriting. So it worked out for me. It doesn't work out for a lot of people.
Ladies and gentlemen,
it's a tough industry. But
ironically, that script was Shawshank Redemption. So
yeah, wait,
a little different than the usual comedy.
Again, I told you I moved out here in 98. I'm not that old. Shawshank's 94. Come on, man. Don't make me older.
Well, we're gonna talk some 90s stuff later. So you did writing for comedians, but on your, like, it, there's like this old.
Actually, this is kind of funny. Not funny, haha, funny. But speaking of writing for comedians, about, I want to say like 5 years ago now, this was already, this is further along in my career. This is, Razzball's already been established. And Kevin Hart wanted to buy into Razzball. Like, he was a fan. I had worked with, whoa, you know, things, different ways into Kevin Hart. But anyway, he wanted to get into Razzball. And I was like, well, how much money are you going to buy? Like, how much are you buying in? And he was like, I'll give you like 3 tweets a week for 50% of the site. I'm like, no, man. I'm like, no, bro. I mean, maybe your tweets are worth something, but I'm not doing a tweet deal.
Wow. How do you, that's hard. I mean, I'm sure Rudy calculated that in his head right away. And I was like, no.
Yeah, no, I don't even know if I took that deal to Rudy. I mean, I'm sure we discussed it at some point, but I mean, that's just like,
he went, beep, beep,
that's
beep,
what,
beep.
But that's kind of like where you, like, that's how like Hollywood works though, because you'll get like a situation where, and that's actually, it's a good way to bring up the fact that the WGA is striking right now. And it's like reasons like that is why the strike is important, because you get in a situation where you're a writer and people are just like, well, can you work for like 6 months for free? I'm like, nah, man, I can't. I can't work for free. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a, I mean, I feel like that's a whole, I mean, we could talk about that forever. I wanted to mention, by the way, every time, so I live in a city that's close to Universal Studios. And sometimes we're like driving to the park, and or even when we're in the city, you know, dropping kids off at school. Whenever I drive by any studios, and this is like a month and a half into the strike, people are still out there. They're still like motivated. Like, you know, there's so much energy still. And I couldn't imagine striking for like a month plus and still having the same sort of like, you know, vigor. I understand, you know, the stress of their situation and the cause and everything is so very important. But at some point, I feel like you get dejected kind of going in day in and day out, and they're still going strong. It's pretty impressive to see.
Yeah. There was also, that was the strike in 08. Was actually how I started Razzball. That was the impetus to start Razzball. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, I did, because I've done my history on you. That was, oh,
okay.
Be...
Okay. I didn't know you read the wiki, but yeah, yeah. I was working with, the Zucker brothers, the guys who did the Airplane Naked Gun movies. And I was writing a script for them. And then it, like, everything came to a halt because of the strike. So I was like walking in a circle in front of CBS Studios. At the time, I lived over by CBS, but it was I was walking in a circle, a real slow circle. It was like a real slow NASCAR race, just walking mm-hmm. a circle, doing the strike, right? And then I was like, "This is, you know, it was like I couldn't do screenwriting." I couldn't do anything really that I wanted to do. And then I was like, I mean, I've always loved fantasy baseball, so I guess I could start a website. That's how naive it was. Like, amazing. It was literally that naive. And I didn't even tell Rudy at the time. Like, I remember, like, I did it for like, I don't know, maybe 6 months. It was like just me writing fantasy baseball thoughts. To like, it was basically me writing a, like a journal. Like, it was just like me writing to myself about,
this is
like,
what year?
It was 08, 06? I believe. Yeah. 07, 08. Cause I, it was 08. It was actually, it was during the last strike. I think it was 08. Okay. Maybe it was 07. Anyway, so I was doing it. I started Razzball, and I was just writing basically to myself nonsense. And then like maybe 6 months in, I told, because Rudy and I were in a league together, and you know, we're best friends as well, but we were in a league. And so I knew he liked fantasy baseball. So I was like, just so you know, I started doing this thing, and it got him excited. And I was like, well, yeah, if you want to, like, you know, if you want to participate in some way, like, you can add content. I don't care. And he was much more esoteric about the whole thing, where he was like, I kind of want to do a study on how bad the ESPN player rater is. And I was like, okay, go for it, man. I just want to write jokes.
And but it's a perfect blend, I think, because you guys are, yeah, it's funny. It's like the two halves that fit make a whole. You guys are really different in a lot of ways. And it's funny that you guys are brought together and such good friends. Rudy's obviously, he's funny too, but he's very more math-based, a quant, so as he calls himself, and you're more the creative humor guy, and it just blends. It works out really well. So that's pretty cool. But
yeah.
So you, but by the way, this is just, if you're saying 08, 09, didn't your like whole beef with like the world's most famous person in fantasy happen like 09? So you like rose to prominence that quickly that you were asked?
Yeah.
To...
You know what? I was, that was, you're talking about the argument I had with Matthew Berry.
Yes. If that's okay to bring up here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fine. I don't care. And I'm sure he doesn't care. Well, I think he probably still holds a grudge like 14 years later, to be honest. Supposedly, I've never actually talked to him, but I've heard he's still not a fan of Razzball because of that, which is honestly, it's so funny. But yeah, I interviewed Matthew Berry for like, they were going around. This is how long ago, like 09 in internet terms is like, you know, it's like it's like a generation ago, because like at the time he was doing fantasy baseball for ESPN and he was going around, like ESPN contacted me and they were like, hey, do you want to interview Matthew Berry for your site as like a way to promote us? It was like a way to promote ESPN, you know, so like to get the word out about ESPN. And I was like,
and you said, let me show you my friend, my colleague's article on your player rater. I'm sure that went over well.
No, but it's so funny though, because of how little that these guys like really are in any way, like, you know, they're just like in a job that they don't want to do. I mean, by that, I mean, the people who are working for ESPN, not Matthew Berry necessarily, but the people who reached out to me, like they are just like in a job that they're just like, whatever, like he wants to go talk to people. Okay. I'll reach out to a few sites. I'll just Google something maybe. Like they had no clue what they were getting into. Like they didn't know that I didn't like ESPN and I had like a bone to pick.
They did no research.
They did no research, or their research left out a vital piece of the puzzle, which was, I'm going to roast him. So I basically, and then like Deadspin was not a terrible website at the time. And then Deadspin picked up like the fact that we roasted Matthew Berry in an interview. And, you know, then it became a bigger thing than I even expected. Like, I didn't think it was going to be that big of a thing. I was just goofing kind of. I don't have any real animosity towards these people. I mean, it's like, it is what it is. I don't care. You know, I was just kind of goofing and then it became something else. But anyway, yeah.
It's a long I have my fun and light side. And then I also have like this, I don't know what it is, like this like kind of professionalism that like when sometimes things get a little awkward to me and I just went back and read it. And it was the most like, it was hilarious and uncomfortable at the same time, because like, oh man, like he literally, like even the words, like he was so not wanting to be there. And then like, yeah. I don't know, man. They're like,
that's the funny thing is too, like, it's funny you get that from that, because like my favorite comedian of all time is probably Andy Kaufman. And I love like the uncomfortable humor. Mm-hmm. Like I love making people uncomfortable, which is not really, I mean, that's not really like a great quality to have, because like we'll get in situations like, and I'll just be like, you know, making people uncomfortable, and it's like that's not really great for a business necessarily. Well, but the good thing is with fantasy sports, it's like everyone's kind of a goof anyway. So it's not really like it would be one thing if I was trying to like pass myself off as like, you know, a smart person to go to for like stock advice or something, but it's like, it's baseball. I know baseball. And the whole reason I even started Razzball originally was like, I saw there was an area for me where I could be like funny, and fantasy sports isn't something necessarily that you have to take serious, because like, you know, people do it as fun. Like this is an escape for people. Like I understand some people want the escape and they also want to win, and they want the best knowledge, and it's like, that's cool. That's totally fine. I get that. I want to win too. Like I'm very competitive. I actually, for the fantasy space, I feel like I'm built well for fantasy sports, because I really am competitive when it comes to like nonsense. Like I'm the most competitive person for like total, like board games. Like I get crazy about board games, you know, so this whole element of like wanting to win, like I get the wanting to win thing, but I also understand it's kind of just supposed to be fun. Like this is all supposed to be fun. Like this is a fantasy sports is not, it's not life or death here. It's like a break from your regular job, and you're looking at your teams and you're like, you know, you're cursing that Christian Carcione Strand isn't called up yet. And
yeah, what's
you,
up with that?
You hate your, and it's like, you hate your pitching staff because like, you know, Lance Lynn is like staring at you on your screen. Like I get all that. Like I get the humor in like the madness of baseball, but
did you bench him for his 16 strikeouts?
I also love baseball. Like you can't, I don't think you can get to where I am and fake your love for baseball or fantasy.
By the way, did you bench Lance Lynn in our?
Oh, totally. Oh, completely. Oh, yeah, man. No, you had to bench him. I don't even feel bad about that, because like if you didn't bench him for that 2 week start, he still had like a 5+ ERA over those two starts. So let's not like, let's put aside the strikeouts, but he still had terrible ratios, and he's been so awful that if you didn't start him, you're into basically S&M, and you enjoy torturing yourself. Like you have a deep seated evil, like in your core, you want to hate yourself if you started Lance Lynn for those two starts.
Unbelievable how that.
But I honestly, I couldn't imagine a worse outcome that he's like throws 16 strikeouts.
Unbelievable.
Anyway, yeah.
Just, by the way, great. I just have to like this here. I didn't even know what to feel, because I remember reading this maybe 10 years ago, your interview with Matthew Berry. But then I look back and it says, and you start with, you were talking about something about hate mail, and then you say, let's say we're close friends. Matthew says, I find this hard to believe already, but go ahead. You say, what? No rapport? Is it my breath? Should I return to the brown nosing? Matthew Berry, it's quite all right. Just go ahead.
So he was really like, honestly, the funny thing is like, even at the time I was like, I mean, honestly, even looking back on it, it was like, I was giving it to him, but he was also at the time, even he was probably the top fantasy guy even then. And he is like, put his claws into that job, and he is not let, you know, he's like, he moved away from ESPN, obviously. But you know what, it really kind of like, it got to me a little bit that like he would not promote Razzball in any way. Like it was basically me promoting ESPN, not ESPN doing like a symbiotic, like, let's promote you. We'll promote you and you promote us. It wasn't that. Like, don't get me wrong. I was still like, you know, I was a complete newbie, and I didn't really earn the respect of like getting promoted, I guess. But it's still nice to take someone who is new to a field and to prop them up a little bit. None of that. There was literally, it was like, I'm not going to help you in any way. Good luck on your journey, Razzball. And I was like, okay, well, if you're not going to promote us, I'm going to give you shit. Sorry.
And then the Deadspin article, probably you probably have a lot of your subscriber base like came from that actually too. It was kind of like make a roundabout way. Somebody read that article, loved it, or like your style of humor, and now they're yeah. your customers
but, for. It's also like in a way it worked out well because like it isn't fantasy. It wasn't fantasy necessarily. It wasn't like, oh, this guy is the best at fantasy, so let's follow him. But it did. It was in a way good for us because it showed us. It showed people who weren't familiar with us exactly who we were. Like it was like we weren't hiding behind like anything with that. It was like, oh, these guys are going to be they're like somewhat like, you know, they're going to be a bit of an asshole to ESPN. Now that could turn some people off. Like there's people who would see that and be like, I don't want to have anything to do with that. But there's other people who'd be like, yeah, that's kind of cool to me. That's interesting. I want to know what else is out there. Like, I am kind of sick of like what ESPN is doing. So yeah, I mean, it was kind of good. It was good. I think it was more good than bad, but you know,
I mean, here you are standing here 15 years later.
Yeah. And I don't want to give too much credit. I mean, there's been a lot of work along the way. Mm-hmm. That was one piece, but yeah, it was probably a helpful piece.
Pivoting real quickly back to your screenwriting days, there is something on, it was like a Reddit or something that you did years ago, and you had mentioned something. I want to really know this story. You mentioned that you wrote jokes for Bobby Brown.
No, I didn't write jokes for him. Bobby Brown. Okay. So here's the story. I'll make it real quick because I've told the story on the Razzball podcast already a few times. And you know, people who are familiar with me are going to be like, oh my God, this is only story. But anyway, I'll say real fast. So at the time, Bobby Brown and Little Kim were doing a sitcom. No, they were doing a movie that was a direct ripoff of the Barbershop movies. Do you remember the Barbershop movies?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. So they wanted to, so they were like, let's do Barbershop, but in a girl salon. It's like, wow, that's a real stretch. You guys are really coming up with interesting stuff. So anyway, I was friends with the guy who was I was friends with the guy who was writing and directing that. And he was friends with Praz from the Fugees, and Praz, which is kind of interesting because Praz right now I think is going to jail for a long time.
Yes.
And I was really like, and it's sort of like around that time when I was in with Praz, like the time when he was getting money from, he was stealing money, I think from like, a guy in China, I want to say. it's a complicated story.
I just read it lately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been meaning, there's a book about it. I've been meaning to read the book. I haven't yet, but I kind of lived through it because I did like 7 projects for Praz. So I was kind of surprised that I wasn't called to testify during
all this. Oh boy.
But anyway, so Praz had, he was like, I want to do the hair salon movie, and I will you do the sitcom version of that? Because I want to do like a you know, because when the movie's popular, as in his brain, he thought this movie was going to be popular. He was like, when it's a smash hit in the movie theaters, I want to have a TV show to back up, to have ready to go like once we have like a popular movie. And I was like, okay, this is nonsense, but you know what, if you're paying me, I'll do it. So basically he was like, he hired me to write the sitcom version of the Bobby Brown Little Kim movie. And so I'd go to the set, and I, because at the time the movie wasn't even made yet, like they were filming the movie, so I'd go to the set and watch like the movie getting made with Bobby Brown and Lil Kim, and you know, and none of them are really actors. so bad. That wasn't even like my worst experience of Praz, but that was one of them. so we went to the set, saw Bobby Brown and Lil Kim doing these scenes, and it was like, oh man, this is gonna be the worst thing I've ever done in my life. So then Bobby Brown sees me and he's like, hey man, you want to come back to my hotel and play dominoes? I'm like, absolutely.
Hell yeah, I'm gonna pass that up.
Absolutely, I want to do that with Bobby Brown. So I ended up going back to it was at the Hermitage, which you might know, in Beverly Hills.
We go nice
to
the spot.
Yep, is a we're in the suite, top floor of the Hermitage. Probably, I want to say like $12,000 to $15,000 a night, like an insane suite. So I'm there with Praz and Bobby Brown, and we're playing dominoes. They're getting high. I didn't smoke anymore. I smoked in college, and then I stopped smoking out of college. Anyway, so they're getting high. We're playing dominoes, and Bobby's like, how about I call Whitney and we go out dancing? I'm like, absolutely.
I'm going to dance with somebody?
Absolutely. Yeah. You want to do that? Absolutely.
You don't say no to those things.
Yes. I was like, absolutely. You want to call Whitney and let's go out dancing. I was like, okay.
Amazing.
So then we go. So Bobby's like, all right, deal. So we make a plan. And I got there so early. And I was half expecting them to stand me up. But you know what? I was wrong. They did not stand me up. So I was outside the club. It was on Santa Monica Boulevard. It was actually by Boys Town, but it wasn't a gay club. But it was in the West Hollywood area. Anyway, so we go. I'm standing outside the club, and like seven black SUVs pull up, and I'm like, whoa, what is going on here? How many people did they bring? And it's like seven black SUVs. Six of them are totally empty. And then there's one with Bobby Brown and Whitney Houston. Like, whoa. I was like, Bobby, what's with the, I'm like, oh, so they so I get introduced to Whitney. I'm like, hey, how you doing? She's like, honestly, you don't want to talk bad about, you know, the dead, but
yeah.
she was so zonked out of her mind. I was like, hey, Whitney, how's it going? And she was like, cool. I'm like, oh man, she was really gone. But anyway,
she didn't ask you about Ricky Nolasco's projections for the second half.
Yes. Yeah. She was like, what's up with his ex Fip? He's supposed to be better. So I say to Bobby, I'm like, Bobby, what's up with all the SUVs, man? He's like, yo, when Whitney and I go out, there's so much paparazzi. We got to take seven SUVs.
They can't find us.
Just to give them the dip. And I'm like, really? I'm like looking around. I was like, I don't think there's any paparazzi here, bro. there's no one around. It's like literally, it's like a club of me, Bobby, and Whitney. So we go in, and it's still early, but eventually it starts to fill in a little bit with like people, and Bobby Brown is just like, he's on the dance floor housing every girl. Whitney's sitting in the corner looking zonked, hanging out with like some girls. I don't want to say what girls, but it was a scene where it's like, they're not really together, are they? And that was just like literally like maybe 3 hours of like one night with them. And I could already tell, I was like, I don't think they're really together. And then Bobby Brown and Whitney did the, this is probably like 05. I want to say, I don't know exactly. I could be wrong in the year, but then like literally within 6 months, they started doing like the Duty Bubble Bravo show. I don't know if you remember that. Being Bobby Brown, I think was the name of it. Yeah. So then they started doing that, and you know, he had a little bit of heat, but people still were not interested in him in a sitcom. So that was the end of that. And anyway, that was pretty much the whole story. Like,
you got paid.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I got paid by Praz. Yeah. I got paid by Praz for like 2 years. It was like Praz. And then Praz would like set me up with like Tricky. I don't know if you know the rapper.
Yeah, Tricky.
Tricky, yeah, like they were friends somehow. So Tricky then had money and he was like, yo, I want to do like movies too. And I was like, sure man, I'm your man. So that was that's like, that's like Hollywood though for you. It's like you never know like where certain things are going to take you, you know. Like I was at the time, like my manager, I was working with, like I had the same manager as Nick Cannon. So he would put me like with Nick Cannon, like, and that was when he was doing like Wilding Out.
Studio taping of that, by the way, randomly.
I was probably there, like writing insane jokes on the side while you were at the Wilding Out taping.
You were in that? You wrote for that?
No, because it was supposed to be quote unquote improv, mm-hmm. but they weren't doing nothing improv.
It was very clearly, at least to me, like not, you know, not completely uneducated eye in the world of comedy and improv, like it was not fully improv.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, they would be like, yeah. So I would be standing off to the side, like doing jokes for Nick Cannon. And then that led to like Mike Epps, and then Mike Epps led to Cat Williams, and then Cat Williams led to Kevin Hart. So that was like, so for a long time, I was just doing a lot of like black comedian jokes. Like that was like, but in the middle of that was like Praz. I was, cause I also like growing up, like I always was into hip hop, and I always felt like more akin I was like always had all black friends, and it was just like, it felt like me, that suited me. So it was like, in some ways, my Hollywood, like, writing went in the direction it was supposed to go in some ways, because that was like as natural as it was for me to do that. And then it was natural for me to do Razzball too, in a lot of ways, because I was doing my other love, like besides comedy, my other love is baseball. So it's like I've always been like a huge baseball fan.
Speaking of that, I don't know how we can possibly pivot from that into talking about Austin Riley, how awful he's been, and AJ Puck on the IL. And I don't want to pivot so much because this is like more interesting. Honestly, but
you had in the one thing though, like how is like you mentioned Austin Riley, which he has been bad for sure, and AJ Puck. AJ Puck's actually been pretty good if it wasn't for the injury, but. Whatever happened with Tyler O'Neill? Did he get like I feel like there's something going on with like Ali Marmol that is like he didn't like Tyler O'Neill from the jump, and he just like put him in the doghouse to never return, right? Like I don't think it has anything to do with an injury anymore. Like Tyler O'Neill, I feel like is just in the doghouse. Like, so yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, on those fantasy news sites, like where it's like, Byron Buxton, and then in parentheses it says like back or something. It should say like Tyler O'Neill, and then in parentheses doghouse.
Yeah.
Like what happened with Tyler O'Neill? Like there's no way he's injured this long. Like he got put on the IL because his personality didn't mesh with Ollie, and now he's just like, they're waiting to trade him. I wouldn't be surprised if by the time this podcast drops, like he's traded, because it doesn't make any sense at all that he would be out this long.
So I've been calling for this. I've been talking about it for months because I'm heavily invested in Tyler O'Neill, who was like my dude. I'm like, okay, last year was the off year. We saw what he was capable of in 21. He's like a, you know, going in the 75, 90 overall range. I'm in. Even if the batting average isn't fantastic, I'm going to get all that he can give. And yeah, it is just such a bad pairing with Marmol. Clearly doesn't like him. We've been talking about free, you know, he's ton for the last few months.
Yeah.
But there has to be something here. I mean, it can't be just that, because I mean, 60-day IL, like, and he's hurting himself and his possibilities of making more money in a career. And he's a dedicated dude, you know, hardworking, Canadian, super powerful athlete. I don't know what the Canadian parts do, but you know what I mean? There's something like there's obviously something not right. And he had that one comment. I think he was like the one guy that fought back, because if you notice, there's a trend with Ollie Marmol, like throwing his dudes under the bus. Like Wilson Contreras signs a new contract, just craps on him. Like,
you know, that's good. Actually, that would be good. Tyler O'Neill, parentheses, under the bus. That's even better than doghouse. Yeah. No, I hear you, man. I feel like it's like, get behind me and we're going to go. I mean, I'm being Ali Marmol at this point. Get behind me and we're going to go, or get out. Because if you're not behind me, you're out. Like,
and he's empowered by, you know, obviously the Jean Mozeliak and like this, this group that they have too much control, but they're kind of like running a, you know, like a pirate ship, you know, yeah. Like it just feels like the wrong ownership. And it's very clear in their record. Whenever I post anything like silly about the Cardinals, a lot of my content on Twitter seems to be Cardinal based, not by design. It's just like they're a situation right now, right? Like, you know, like Mike, the situation from Jersey Shore, they are a situation at the moment.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals fans, they're eating it up because, I mean, they're pissed. I mean, I would be too. This is a storied franchise. You have Goldschmidt and Arenado as the base. You're supposed to always have good pitching at a good pitching park. You have, you know, storied history, and you're watching like the Reds potentially like way ahead of you. You're last place in the damn division. Like, what's going on?
No, so, yeah, definitely. And it's a totally winnable division too. So I hear you, man. I think like I was saying on Razzball the other day, like when Hicks went three games in a row and got a save three games in a row, I was like, I almost feel like Marmol was doing that hoping that he would like fail the third time. Like, it was like, who throws someone three games in a row? It's like, why would, like, it doesn't, like, because they have Gallegos, excuse me.
Jordan Hicks now.
I can't say anyone's name, but I can say Hicks. But yeah, I mean, it's just like, I just feel like he's, I don't know, man. Like, he almost feels like his own worst enemy. He being Ollie Marmol. Like, it feels like he is just like, he doesn't know when to get out of the way almost. Like, it's like in the major league level, I almost feel like the less you do, the more you're revered as a genius, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, just take a step back, man. Like, it's like, you have a team as like with the Cardinals where they could probably win that division by doing nothing. Like, just like, they just need to like perform up to their talent level. But yeah, they're a mess. And I think it starts with him. I think Marmol, I think he's got to go, man. I hate him.
It's a long time. It's a long time coming. Well, it's him and it's Mozeliak. Those dudes, they need to go. By the way, no surprise. Like, so this is so funny. This is like no surprise. Like, having you on, I just knew that they were like, we have like so many different things and like kind of only like an hour 15 to squeeze it in. But I just kind of knew that we were going to go off like the rails, the different subjects. There's, you know, different things I wanted to cover. As a matter of fact, my gardeners came early. So now I got like this, you know, blowing. They had other gardeners earlier. So it's just been absolute like, you know, insanity. But having you on, man, this has been fantastic. There are a few other things I wanted to talk to you about, specifically this whole thing about like speedless bats, and we're looking specifically at guys like Jose Abreu, Josh Bell, guys that, I mean, highly drafted. We understood that in, you know, going into the season, the guys that don't steal bases at all, there was going to be an issue with them and their values because they're essentially probably only contributing to like three categories. I mean, like right now, Abreu and Bell on your player rater, both those guys are beyond beyond 400 overall on the player rater, hitters and pitchers included. Guys like Rowdy Tellez, Jake Cronenworth isn't stealing much. Carlos Correa, Eugenio Suarez, those guys are all like 250 plus. Like, they're kind of worthless in fantasy now. So I'm thinking about next season. And I know it's a little early to be thinking about that, but like, I mean, don't you think we might as an industry be sort of super sensitive and like push these guys heavily down that don't steal bases? Like, do you think there's going to be like a major market overcorrection? Like, what would you do? What do you think we would do?
You know, I've always been like under, like, I feel like the number one thing you can do when you're drafting bats, at least, is like try and get a five category performer. So For at first base, that becomes difficult, obviously. There's not a ton of them. So with like Abreu and Josh Bell specifically, you know, I think they're gonna get buried. I think Abreu is old. I think Bell has major ground ball issues. I never really bought into any of these guys that you're talking about, except for Tellez. Tellez, I thought, could be better, and he's been really slumping. I think it's been like almost a month now since he's had like a home run, something like that. Like, I think he has like one run. He scored one run, I think, in like the last like 17 games or something bizarre like that. So he's been really slumping. So specifically about like those guys, Abreu and Josh Bell, I don't really like in like specifics. Tellez, I kind of like, but as like a corner man, utility play just for like power, and maybe if you get lucky, a little bit of average, but not even. Like Telus is really just about like power. And Correa, I always felt like Correa was so overrated because of like the real baseball talk on Correa is like, there's a lot of it. There's a lot of talk about like, oh, you know, like he's going to be a Met or he's going to be a Padre or wherever he was going to sign, or a Giants, Mets. Like there's all these places Correa was going to sign, and he was getting a lot of publicity during like the off season, where I always felt like he was going to be overrated because of that. Cause like that was for his glove and his arm and for real baseball. Whereas like with fantasy, Correa's never really been a great fantasy guy. Like at best, he's been like top 75 on the player rater when he would have like a good average and hit like, you know, 25-ish homers and have good counting stats, but he never chipped in any speed. So I've always felt like Correa was overrated. And then you have like, you know, so whether or not I'm going in on guys that will be like not necessarily, you know, steals guys, it will depend. To be honest, it's like it all depends on like your draft build. Like if your build is looking like a situation where you can carry a guy like a Correa and he falls much later than he was, then okay, maybe I get in on Correa finally, but I've really never been interested. So I would say I could see myself drafting a four category guy, but it's really going to come down to draft build more than, and it'll come down to the specific player more than whether I'm going to, you know, in a general sense, whether or not I'm going to avoid guys who don't give any speed. Like in general, I want to avoid guys who don't give speed, but specifics, yeah, I could see myself drafting one of them if they're at the right place in drafts, but Correa specifically, I wouldn't be shocked to see him next year still be overdrafted because for whatever reason, people love Carlos Correa in like fantasy. Like I don't necessarily understand why. Like he's barely been a push on fantasy value and sometimes like a push, most times just overrated. Like he's never really, you know, given back his fantasy value at all. And then yeah, like Abreu's just old. He's just old, yeah. Man. I don't know, you know.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of what I was thinking. I feel like I've been talking a lot more this season about the separation between real life players and fantasy players, and Carlos Correa definitely fills that bucket because he is so good defensively, but of course because he's not excessive in any specific category, right? I mean, he's not really a 35 home run guy. He's, you know, he hits for good average, but not elite. So
also
yeah, I mean,
with him, sorry, not to interrupt, but with Correa specifically, I feel like a lot of that was Scott Boras like pushing a free agent to get as much money as he could. And because Boras has so many of the major sports writers in his pocket that you have a guy who's like, you know, like John Heyman or Ken Rosenthal or Passan, you have all those guys who are like, they have such big reaches. So they're able to push this like huge thing, this huge narrative about Correa that makes it like to the average fantasy player, you know, like the player who doesn't check in until like March, like that person hears all offseason about Correa's, like, you know, he's where he's signing and how much he's signing for. And that gets so like built into his fantasy price, even though it shouldn't, but it does. It gets built into that price. And then people are drafting him at like, you know, this outrageous spot in drafts. And you're like, wait, isn't he a 25, 270 hitter at best? Like, that's fine. In certain leagues, that's fine. Like that's not terrible, but it's not good where he was getting drafted at. It wasn't good there. And that's what he's always done. Like he's never really been like, you know, like even Alex Bregman, who I didn't necessarily like, even he had one huge year. Like Carlos Correa never really had that like insane year. He had good years. Don't get me wrong. Like, he had definitely like valuable years, but never like an insane year. Like, he was always like, okay, he's good. I mean, he's fine, but never was going to be like 30 homer, 15 steal, 280 hitter. That was never happening. He was never like, he just doesn't run very fast. Like, he's a legitimately slow guy.
You want to play a little game of a little speed round game that I have put together?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So this is kind of a mix of different things here. I mean, I know we're more 80s kids, but this is a little bit more 90s, and then a little baseball mixed in. So a little game I put together trying to get my best creative brain going when I have such a creative guest here appearing with me. I need to kind of step up my game. Hopefully maybe I can write jokes for you one day. But so I'm going to just fire it off and just tell me what you think here. You can go into explanation as well if you want. My first question to you, Mr. Gray, Framber Valdez of the Astros or Kevin Gausman of the Blue Jays on your fantasy team for the rest of the season, your horse you're going to ride into the sunset to win your league?
Yeah, one of those. I will say that's actually pretty close. Like, I liked both of them coming into the year. I won't go into a long diatribe about either of them. I'll just say I'm going Gausman, but it's close.
Okay. Rank these five movies from your favorite to your least favorite. Edward Scissorhands, Groundhog's Day, Dazed and Confused, Friday, and The Birdcage. Try to really get out there with them.
Wow, those are pretty disparate movies. I'll say...
And you've seen them all.
Yeah. Okay. I've seen them. Groundhog's Day is like... I think Groundhog's Day is, honestly, it's kind of a masterpiece. Honestly, it's a really difficult, because I know I won't go too far into the story, but I had a similar project that I was working on, and Groundhog's Day is really like, that's a tough nut to crack as a writer. It's really like, I've read the script for Groundhog's Day numerous times. It wasn't really funny, to be honest. Bill Murray made it funny. But it's a masterpiece. Groundhog's Day is really like incredible movie. Dazed and Confused isn't far behind. Then I'll say Friday, Birdcage, and I'm not really a big Tim Burton guy. Edward Scissorhands, okay. I don't know. It's just not my thing, really.
You know what's funny is, like, for whatever reason, like, Dazed and Confused, good movie at all, but it's not one of my favorites. It's not one of those from my age group. Like, it was like a kind of huge cult following. Just wasn't as much for me. I loved, obviously, Nathan Lane, Robin Williams, The Birdcage. Friday is my favorite because that's the movie that, you know, we all went to see in the theaters multiple times in the middle of, you know, high school days. You know, first, you know, discovered weed, everything. Groundhog's Day.
I was supposed to write for Chris Tucker. I don't know if I should say it. Well, no one's listening. I'll dish a small dish. It's not the nicest thing to say, but I was supposed to write for Chris Tucker, and the guy who I was supposed to write it for, like the producer, is like, he can't read. I was like, real, like really, like can at all? And he's like, no. I was like, and then I was like,
how does he do script? How does he memorize script?
I think he just goofs, to be honest. I mean, he seems like a nice guy, so I don't want to like bag on him, but
yeah, nobody's here. This isn't gonna be like, you know, Matthew Berry part two here.
Yeah.
By the way, if you know we made it big, is so if Matthew Berry unfollows me on Twitter because I had you on the show, then we know that people are listening.
That's the kind of thing where it's like, he still doesn't follow Razzball, like, I don't know. What is this? 13 years later? Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. Like, honestly, like, talk about someone who's like, I feel like there's certain, and this isn't just Matthew Berry, by the way. I think in fantasy in general, there's a lot of people who don't want to see other people succeed. Like, I mean, in fantasy, like in the industry, I mean, like, because it's very competitive. Like, and I get it. Like, I think a lot of people look at it like, if he succeeds, then I'm not succeeding. And I want to win the league, and I want to be the best website, and I want to do this. Like, I feel like that's a big part of fantasy in general.
Yeah.
Like people don't promote other people in fantasy. It's not, it's hard. It's hard to find people to promote.
I guess it depends. It also depends, like, I mean, we'll kind of have our worlds, but I think there's a fraction of our industry that I think does a pretty good job of that. Right. I mean, we do have, at least compared to like football. Right. But there are a lot of really good eggs in, I think, in our industry community. I feel like it's gotten better.
Yeah, no, totally. No, I agree. I think there are some, but I think there's a lot of people at the top in fantasy that are just like, you know, they don't want to give up the throne. Like, they don't want to, like, you know, hand it off to other people. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
This will be a little undercover investigation that we'll get going for the next time that we have you on. I did want to mention that for whatever reason. So I feel like when I was a kid watching all these movies, like, I kind of liked everything, but for whatever reason, what stood out to me is I really didn't like Funny Farm with Chevy Chase and Andy McDowell, who happens to be in Groundhog Day as well. I just recall, like, I don't know, there's something about Andy McDowell I just don't like. And that movie, I mean, and I always liked Chevy Chase and everything, but that kind of like just kind of changed things around for me. And it actually turns out he was like, you know, one of the biggest dicks in Hollywood.
I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that, but supposedly Chevy Chase is supposed to be an asshole. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've heard that.
Yeah. Well, we can go down the rabbit hole, but I have more speed round questions for you. And then we got to set our lineups for Tuesday. For those of you in daily leagues. Okay. Reds or Brewers or other to win the NL Central?
I'm going to say the Brewers. I don't think the Reds have the arms necessarily. I mean, I like that from a real baseball standpoint. I like that they shut down Hunter Green for a little while. I think it probably is going to help them in the long run to have him, like, you know, take a 2-week sabbatical, but I don't think that. And the Reds park, it's almost like Coors Central. Like, it's really a hard park to pitch in. So I worry that I don't think the Reds are going to be able to deal with the arms that they have. I don't think they're going to be able to hang with the Brewers, especially if they get back Woodruff whenever after the All-Star break, maybe, who knows? I don't know when he's coming back, but I think the Brewers might have better arms. And I wouldn't put money on it, but I think the Brewers are probably still my favorite there.
If forced to hear one song and repeat entire weekend nonstop, so that starts Friday afternoon till Sunday afternoon, and it's just in your head the whole time, Aqua's Barbie Girl or the Macarena? Just imagine both. You had to have one.
I love both of these songs, obviously.
Which one would you less likely go?
Let's go, Barbie. Let's go party. I had to go Barbie party. Barbie.
Which one will cause you less to go, like, take like a ship, little submarine thing down to see the Titanic? Too soon.
That is you're basically describing Gitmo right now. Barbie. You want to hear Barbie Girl or Macarena? Hey, guy from Hezbollah, do you want to hear Barbie Girl or Macarena? What do you think? Okay. I'd take Barbie Girl, but
okay.
I think the Macarena is probably a better song to choose, though. Like, now that I thought about it, because you can actually do the dance, where Barbie Girl, mm-hmm. you're just like, let's go Barbie, let's go party.
Yeah.
And then you're crazy within 8 hours, where you're actually getting exercise and you're chill, doing it.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. Luis Arias, he's at 400 at the time of this recording. This is his batting average. Will he finish over 370?
No.
Okay. Kelly Kapowski from Saved by the Bell or Kelly Taylor from Beverly Hills 90210?
Kelly Taylor.
Wow. All right. You're a contrarian, I see.
Am I?
I feel like if you put that up, I think it would be like a 64. Whenever I see anything about the 90s, like, everybody just seems obsessed.
You might be right. It might be like 80-20.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's the wrong pick.
I prefer gentlemen for blondes. Makes sense.
Rank these three for the rest of season in home runs. Soler, he's got 21. Matt Olson, 20. Kyle Schwarber, 20.
I'll say Olson, Schwarber, Soler.
Okay. Biggie or Tupac? And please take your West Coast bias out of this. You're East Coast. So, hey.
Yeah. You know, this is funny because Biggie or Tupac, I feel like the go-to, like everyone always says Biggie, but Tupac was like a legit like poet. Like Tupac was like insanely talented, and like, not to take anything from Biggie, but Biggie was really like, I feel like if Biggie would have lived like another 20 years, like what did Puff Daddy do after, like, you know, after like those, that music was so of that moment with Biggie, like, you know, I feel like I could get shot if I was in Bed-Stuy right now saying this, but I mean, mm-hmm. Tupac was a far better rapper than Biggie. I mean, Biggie's second album, he was already repeating rhymes. Like, he was already saying the same stuff again.
That's a good point. Good point. That's a whole nother show too, by the way. We could talk, we could do an hour.
We could do a show. I've always found fascinating is how like rappers and professional wrestlers of like their lifespan is like 30 years younger than everyone. Like the guys we grew up with liking as rappers and pro wrestlers are like, they're not living long.
All these people. Yeah. All these guys, everyone, like you just like, look them
like
up.
So and many remember, guys, like I'd be like Guru from Gangstar. I'm like, how did he pass it? Like, why did he die?
And he
like,
had what? A rare illness, I believe, of some sort.
I know.
And that wasn't even
no, I know why he died, but I'm saying like in the general sense of like, and like wrestlers too. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, again, I know why, because, you know, they're doing steroids, but, and, you know, other drugs, a lot of cocaine. And yeah, I mean, they didn't live right, but they're also like, man, they are really like just not living long either. Okay. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I can't actually ask the baseball question next. I have to ask my next culture question. and then we'll go two baseballs in a row. And because the question is, what would Dave Grohl be doing right now if Kurt Cobain was still alive?
Dave Grohl is like, who's a good comparison with like baseball. I'm trying to think of a good, oh man. I don't know.
Wally Pipp?
No. Wally Pipp, that's funny. No, I think Dave Grohl, this is a very specific Dave Grohl thing too that drives me a little bit nuts, but he's like the brown noser of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where it's like he goes every year and he introduces people, and he's like, he's such a huge like rock and roll nerd that he's now been inducted by like for like three different like times he's been inducted, like in like Nirvana and the Foo Fighters, I think solo, like he's Dave Grohl is like, I feel like he's just, he knows how to play the game. If that makes sense. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, and that, and also, I mean, honestly, like, if you could, I mean, you can't even,
like, it's not surprising that he went on from Nirvana and he was the one who founded the Foo Fighters, because, mm-hmm. like, it makes sense if you think about it, because he feels like the kind of guy who's, like, who calls you up and is, like, hey, man, let's, you know, you want to go, we got practice in, like, 20 minutes. You want to go get, like, a coffee? And
let's
like,
get a smoothie.
Yeah, like, get a smoothie. Like, it's, like, Dave Grohl, give me
drink
some,
up, man. This
give
is
me
good
some
for you.
Me
good
time,
for you.
Bro. Stop being such a nice guy, you know?
Yeah, and my question was in any way to like kind of put down Dave Grohl. I think my thinking
I think he's a better person than he is a musician. And
that's
I'm
a good
really,
way to put it.
But I'm really far from like, I don't know music outside of rap. And I just happen to know that Dave Grohl is really big in like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because I happen to watch like the HBO, or now it's Max, I guess, the Max induction ceremony. So, and I know he's always there like promoting people, which is nice. I mean, that's a nice thing to do, but it's like, oh, come on, man. Come on, bro.
You know what? I have a good rap story for you. I don't think I've told you this, and maybe people don't know either. Maybe they don't care, but by this point, they've already turned
this off. I have a really good rap story, but go ahead. What's your rap story?
So it was like, I think it was with my college friends. It was like 2007. One of my friends was this like event planner, And basically, she invited us to this thing where we were going to be part of the legendary rapper Rakim and sort of posse, where we'd be able to come on stage. And I mean, we're just like, you know, a bunch of like young kind of, you know, white kids for the most part. But we got to also hang out in their area before the event. I forgot, this was like a Paramount or some random place. It was a smaller event. But they said, okay, when we arrived, like, oh, here's Rakim's area. Him and his wife are going to come soon with some of their friends. Help yourself, you know, to whatever you want. There were bottles of champagne. There were fruits. There were all these kind of things. So we were young kids. We, you know, helped ourselves, started, you know, pouring champagne, drinking, whatever. And Rakim comes up, you know, and a few of his friends, and his wife starts going things like, my God, where's the champagne? Basically like cursed us out for, we could drink all the stuff. But anyways, they replenished it rather quickly. Rakim himself was really nice. And then we just went on stage with him, you know, like awkwardly kind of dancing in the background. So that's my little Rakim story.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. Nice.
What's yours?
I was hired to write a music video to go along with the release of a song for Crooked Eye, who's a rapper, not a famous rapper, but he's a rapper, and he was in Death Row Records. So I remember, like, I didn't really even know his music at the time. So I like Googled him, and it turned out that he had like this, like he was the first.
A Crooked Eye?
Crooked Eye, yeah.
No, did he have a Crooked Eye?
Oh, no.
You went on Google.
It was for, it was for, he named himself after St. Ides. Anyway, it's stupid. But anyway, I Googled him, and it was like he was like the first rapper ever to get out of Death Row Records. Like, that was his claim to fame at that point, at least.
It was a big deal back then.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. So anyway, I go to the studio where he's laying down tracks or whatever, and I'm like, hey man, so that's crazy about like the the Suge Knight stuff and everything. And he's like, yeah. And he's he starts like, you know, dropping f-bombs, and he's like, saying all this shit. And it's like, okay. I was like, so you don't see Suge anymore? And he's like, no, of course I do. He's in the studio next door. I'm like, what am I doing here, man? I was like, Cricket. I don't remember what I
he walks
him.
In. He's like, is that that guy that recommended me to take Ryan Ludwig in the third round?
I was like, yeah, man, I gotta get, I think I'm double parked. Trying to be in the crossfire between you and Suge.
No. During that time, the only way you got out of Death Row was, unfortunately, 6 feet under.
Either through a window or getting shot.
Or he hung vanilla. Didn't he hang Vanilla Ice?
Vanilla Ice. Yeah. It was insane story. That was one of the guys. That was the story that Cat Williams set me up with that, which I should have known at the time. I don't know if you remember when Cat Williams he got arrested because he pulled a gun on like his neighbor.
Yeah,
that was the time when I was working with Cat Williams. So I should have known right then not to take job opportunities from Cat Williams. It was like, dude,
yeah, never trust a man named Cat who spells it in that way. It makes sense. Yeah. And then from that, that perfectly pivots into my next question. Zach Gallen is the current NL Cy Young winner, favorite. If he falters, who's most likely to win? Is it Kershaw, Wheeler, Strider, someone else?
Kershaw is gonna. I think Kershaw beats Gallen if Kershaw stays healthy. It feels like a swan song thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I don't like Zach Gallen, obviously. I mean, all those guys could potentially win it. I don't think Wheeler and Strider are going to have the ratios that, you know, a lot of like old time Cy Young voters like to look at. But yeah, I mean, I would say Kershaw probably would be my number one right now. But Gallen's like, if it's Kershaw's 1A, Gallen's probably 1B, and then Strider is a far distant second, and then Wheeler is behind Strider.
My last question to you, and this is a trick because it's an 80s question. These are two of my favorite movies still to this day. Movies keep come and they go, and yeah. none have been able to replace these two. Actually, if you throw Swingers in, the Jon Favreau, Vince Vaughn film, that's in my top three, but these are my other two, and I just can't get over them. But I wanted you to pick one if you had to. It's Coming to America, and it's Trading Places, two Eddie Murphy movies.
They are both so good. Honestly, that's why we get along, because I feel like those are like two of my favorite movies of all time too. Like those are movies that like when I would go to like studios and like pitch like or meet and greets, I'd go like to do meet and greets, and they would ask me like what are my favorite movies of all time. Like it would be like Coming to America or Trading Places would be like they would be up there with two of the best. God, man, I miss Eddie Murphy. I mean, obviously he's still alive, but yeah. I mean, I miss that Eddie
that
Murphy.
Era. Yeah,
you know, like that Eddie Murphy was. God damn it, he's so fucking funny, man.
Brilliant.
Oh my God, like Delirious or Raw are like so goddamn funny. Like still to this day, like he is like Eddie Murphy is brilliant. Honestly, okay. Anyway. That was just a stall tactics. I'm going to say Trading Places.
Okay. It's an impossible question. They're both.
You can't lose with either though.
By the way, two things that you probably don't know this. I did a few things also, but like on the acting side, I was a kid. I was like 10 years old. I did like a commercial. I was like, you know, in a soap opera, like, you know, little bit roles. But I did start writing. I mean, I was a kid. It's silly stuff. I remember I started writing the script for Coming to America 2. I don't know. I got to maybe like 30 pages and then school started again. And then, for Back to the Future 4. And I don't even remember what the heck I wrote about, but I remember like I was really into that. So I wish I had tapped into that side, but then again, I wouldn't be doing, you know,
true story. I have, next to my bed, I have a framed picture of Michael J. Fox. I love Michael J. Fox too.
Man.
Back to the Future is like, I just recently watched a documentary about him too. It wasn't as sad as I thought it was going to be. Anyway, Back to the Future is another like brilliant movie. Mm-hmm. I like terrible movies. Like, well, not terrible.
But is it really? But like it maybe to people now new, you know,
no,
new
I
now
know.
To
but, but I feel like if you're in Hollywood, like that was like, especially going like and getting my master's degree, like in grad school, people would be like, oh, what's your favorite movie? I'd be like, Coming to America or Trading Places. People would be like, get out of here, bro.
Yeah.
Get out of here, man. Trading Places. Like one person's like, oh, the bicycle thief. Oh, I love Raging Bull. And I'd be like, Trading Places.
And I mean, and that's also the great Robert Zemeckis, right? He did, you know,
oh my God. Zemeckis is brilliant, man. Like I had one of my film classes was a guy who was good friends with Zemeckis. So we used to make fun of him because everything he would say would be like, Zemeckis told me. That's how he would start everything. It'd be like, Zemeckis told me. But you know what? It was okay because Zemeckis was brilliant. Like Zemeckis is like some of his work, like Forrest Gump, by the way, should not work. That's a movie that should not work. It's like, it's a ridiculous movie, but it works because Zemeckis makes it work. Like he even made that stupid Polar Express work. And that was like, who cares? A fucking train movie. I don't care, but he made it work.
Yeah, anyway. I was trying to explain. We were watching this show on Netflix. It's like in its fourth season. It's about a plane that it disappeared and the people came back. Like,
you talking about Lost?
No, it's like the new Lost. I forgot. But it's a Zemeckis thing. I was trying to explain to my wife.
That would be the funniest bit ever. It'd be like, so we're watching this movie. I mean, excuse me, we're watching this TV show, and it's like it's about like the West Wing, and it's got like Martin Sheen. You mean the West Wing? Oh yeah, that's it. Lost, bro. No, I know what you're talking about. I don't know the name of that show either.
Yeah, I'll remember. It's like The Arrival. It's something. Anyways, doesn't matter. Watch it if you have time. If you can figure out what the hell I'm talking about. This has been great. We didn't, you know, we talked a little baseball. I feel like we've had a string of very like solid baseball, you know, deep down guests, and you are too, of course. But that's kind of not the reason why I brought you here. I wanted to talk about your history in in the world, right? Because it's different than so many people's. To me, it's very interesting to hear. As you mentioned, I do think we have a lot of similarities, except, you know, differences, like you're funny. But this is like, this is great to me. I really enjoy it. And so I wanted to give you the floor for like any final words, things you want to promote of that sort.
I think if you're listening to this, you probably know all the stuff that we have over at Razzball, like the Streaminator and the Hittertron and the Player Raider. I'm terrible at promotion. I think if you're interested, if you like what you've heard and you don't know Razzball, just go to Razzball and, you know, give us a shot.
Perfect. Perfect. And dude, this is great. Yeah, we got to do more like we could just like talk 90s and
80s. This reminded me of like there was a brief period during 2020 when people would do podcasts that had nothing to do with baseball.
Yeah,
do you remember that? The pandemic podcast. You go back and you listen to some of those, and it's like, we had on at the time it was me and Jeff, we were doing the Razzball one, and we had on like rappers. We had rappers on the top. We had other like people on that had nothing to do with like baseball. Like I don't even remember. I mean,
I had you guys on too. Remember we did like a live stream show and we talked about like life and history.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's just like, you know, that's what this felt like a little bit. Hopefully people weren't completely bored, but yeah.
No, definitely. This is not boring at all. But if you're here to learn anything about baseball, maybe you got a few nuggets there. Just know Clayton Kershaw most likely going to win the NL Cy Young.
I was surprised you skipped over the 12th pick for 2024. You skipped over that question. Okay, read your question.
Okay,
go ahead.
Okay, if you had
I'm setting you up right now to give you crap, but go ahead, read it.
Okay, right now, if you had to pick, you got the 12th overall pick and for next year's draft, it's 5x5 roto, you have to choose one of Julio Rodriguez and Corbin Carroll. Which one of those two are you taking?
There is no way either of those guys are making it to pick 12. There's no way.
I just had to throw out a number.
Literally okay, eight. Not going to happen, dude. It's not going to happen.
Julio, if he continues like basically doing kind of being like, it's that instinct.
Julio Rodriguez is so good, bro.
Yes.
He's so good.
He doesn't return second round value.
Okay, so Julio Rodriguez maybe has a shot. This is like recency bias, though, that I think trips up a lot of people.
Of course.
It trips up me too, by the way, but it trips up so many people. Like I was thinking today, like how like a Kelenic, Jared Kelenic, in April, people were like, the breakout is here. And now it's like, should I drop him? Like, yeah, even though I thought in April, the breakout was here. I thought it was happening, but it shows you like when you get like with recency bias, you see this. So like right now you're saying Julio Rodriguez, it could be there at 12 and he could, I guess, technically. But I feel like he's going to have a huge second half and he's going to be a top three pick again. Corbin Carroll is going to be a top, like both of these guys, if they make it out of the top five, I'll be shocked to be honest. But if they're both there at pick 12, which I don't think they will be, I'll say Corbin Carroll a little bit, maybe Corbin Carroll just a hair more interesting because of the speed. But I love both of them. Julio Rodriguez and Corbin Carroll are there at pick 12, I'm saying I'm taking both. I'm going. I'm gobbling them up. I'm doing a gobble. I'm gobbling them up.
And that's the thing. If Julio Rodriguez just kind of continues to sort of peter patter for the remainder of the season, which is unlikely, and just ends up like a third round value or whatever, there's going to be like this little bit of a bias where his ADP will be like, you know, it won't be first round. It'll be like, okay, there's so many other good players we want. We'll make him a second rounder. And then all of our articles will start coming out. Why Julio Rodriguez is really a first rounder.
Exactly. That's the thing. That's the thing that drives me crazy though. Cause I could do a whole podcast. I could do an hour and a half just talking about ADP, because you get into a situation where people are like, wow, I can't believe Julio Rodriguez is going at 25 overall. And then you see that person's rankings and they have him ranked at 25. You're like, what? Why are you 25 if you're surprised he's going at 25. It's like he's going at 25 because that's where you've ranked him. Rank him at 10 if you think he's worth 10. Like, oh.
If you're going by ex Woba alone, you know, like, why draft like Julio Rodriguez in the second round when you can draft Jorge Mateo in the 20s?
Like with your Taylor Ward thing with, like, you love Taylor Ward coming into the year. I did too, by the way. I wrote a sleeper post. I love Taylor Ward. So I'm not, I'm not bagging on you. Like, I totally love Taylor Ward. And I still think he could be good, by the way.
Oh, by the way, and if he's bad, I'm not giving up on Taylor Ward.
Hold on.
If he's bad, you wrote it first. Remember? Let's not forget that.
I did write it first. Yeah, no, I love Taylor Ward. But anyway, it's like Taylor Ward is – this is the problem, actually, I have with sleepers. And maybe you can have me on again in the offseason. We can talk about sleepers. Because I'll say, like, I love Taylor Ward. I think he's a quote-unquote sleeper. And I'm ranking him at 80 overall. Well, he's no longer a sleeper at 80 overall, by the way. So now it's like, but his ADP is 110. Well, yeah, I like him more than 110. That's why I ranked him before that. Like, that's always like, that always trips me up because people are like, hey, Gray, hey, handsome face and everything, but I got a question for you. Why exactly are you ranking Taylor Ward so high? Should I draft him at 80 or should I wait until his ADP at 130? I was like, I don't know. Just draft him. I don't know.
Just get him.
Just get him. And, you know, by the way, you probably should have not got him. Oops.
Yeah. Oops. No, there's still, I'm holding.
There's plenty of time. I still love him. I still love him.
There's going to be this like 3 week stretch of just like loveliness where he's just like the, you know, the poster boy. They're going to consider him like on MLB The Show 25. I mean, it's going to be a big deal. speaking of big deals,
people are going to be like, okay, Julio Rodriguez, Corbin Carroll, or Taylor Ward? Which one?
I'm telling you, it's the real deal here. Great. Thank you so much again for coming on. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon. I wish you best of luck in the remainder of our fantasy season here. All right. For Razzball's Gray Albright, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll catch you next week.